And I'm going to connect two important moments, the first of which you heard read to you in the scripture from Genesis, the call of Abraham, and then going all the way to the end of the Old Testament to the book of Daniel and seeing how God's people sort of respond to this call when they are living in exile. They're living in a foreign land under foreign rule, and how that might relate to us and the pastors and those doing ministry through PPMI. So as we had read, after the beginning stories of Genesis, the creation of mankind, and seeing how sin was beginning to take over, we see God call Abraham to leave his home and to go to a new land, and he doesn't tell him what he'll do. So maybe those of you who are called sometimes don't know exactly what you're going to be doing. Abraham did not know what he was going to be doing, but he knew that this was part of a plan and that God said, through him and through your descendants, I will bless all people. So what did Abraham have to sacrifice? This talk is going to be focused on this idea of self-sacrificial love. What did Abraham have to give up in order to follow God's call? Well, you see, at the beginning there, go from your country, your people, and your household. Right? So Abraham would have had to leave his family, would have had to leave his language. We know because he had servants and possessions that he took with him that he was high class, which in Mesopotamian society was very rare. You're talking about 5% of the people who are sort of property and of status, and then 95% of people would be day laborers and slaves. So that's a pretty good position to be in. And he left that top 5% in order to follow God's call. And so he doesn't know where he's going. He gave up a lot. But through this sacrifice, God has a plan. So what was God calling Abraham and his descendants to? Well, he makes this pretty clear as to Isaac in Genesis 26, and then to Jacob in chapter 28, we have this same idea of this covenant with God repeated, that through you, all nations, all peoples of earth will be blessed. So why did Abraham have to leave Mesopotamia? Why did he have to leave the center of development in order to be a blessing? Shouldn't he have stayed there? Well, again, if you know the context of Abraham's story being one of, you know, Cain and Abel and the flood and the Tower of Babel, we have humanity is not quite doing the right thing. They're not following God's design in Mesopotamia. And that culminates in the Tower of Babel, right? Them trying to put themselves in the position of God and live the way that they want to rather than following God. And so Abraham is called away from this. I like to say it's kind of like he's going to summer camp, wilderness camp, because Canaan is not developed. It is the wilderness. And so there God will train up him and his family to then grow and be a blessing to the nations once they're ready. Now, if you know the story of the Old Testament, this doesn't go great. There are certainly high points, there are moments where God works through the Israelites, but overall they really are stuck in their idolatry and the ways of the world. They will eventually inherit the promised land that God promised to them, and they're given God's law to be an example of justice and generosity to the nations, but again, most of the time, this is not how they live. And even their, you know, their great figures like Abraham and Moses and David, they make mistakes. In fact, the next thing Abraham does after this passage is he goes to Egypt and he's afraid for his life, and so he tells his wife, say you're my sister so that they don't kill me. And so he's sort of showing a bit of mistrust that leads to a problematic relationship with the first nation that he encounters. So they make mistakes. And we're just going to zoom all the way to the end of the Old Testament where God has sort of, maybe you say he's had enough, right? He's forgiven them. countless times. He sent many prophets to ask them to do justice and to love mercy and to stop abusing this position that he's given them, but this is to no avail. They now look just like every other nation, and they're not following his call. And so God says, okay, it's time for some consequences. You're going to be conquered by the great empire of the time, Babylon, and taken to live in this fallen empire. And so the blue arrows are representing Abraham's journey. God called him from Mesopotamia, around the land of Babel, and down into Canaan. And now the people are leaving Canaan and following that same path back to the very center of sort of human sin, right? The fallen empire. And while they're living in Babylon, God calls them to something uncomfortable. He asks them to serve King Nebuchadnezzar and the people of this empire. And so in the book of Daniel, that's what we find Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego doing. And if you want to turn to Daniel 3, I will be sort of walking through the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So there's the most famous stories in Daniel are the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and the story of Daniel in the lion's den. And what we'll notice today is that they have the same sequence, they have the same message, and the main difference is that there's a different empire, a different king who's sort of claiming to be God of the region. And so in Daniel chapter 3, this is King Nebuchadnezzar, who's made a golden statue of himself and says that everybody must worship it. And so everybody is brought together, and the herald proclaims that all the people who are there, they'll hear all this music, this great combination, symphony, and at this moment they should fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not will immediately be thrown into the furnace. Now in verse 12, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it says, you know, these people come to the king and they say, they pay no attention to you, your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you set up. So this story is a really wonderful one for us as Christians in America and those in India. You know, we live in a broken society. We have a corrupt government. There are so many idols that we struggle with. There are things that we are told to bow down to or ways that we should live our life. And so I challenge you, in order to sort of put yourself in the story, is to think, what is something that you feel pressured to bow to? What is it that we are told in our context that we should be living for? So some idols that I struggle with, you know, what I do defines me. I need to be very productive, and if I'm not doing, then I'm not really of value. And of course, you know, focus on finances. We always feel like we want to be in a good position there, wanting more. And sometimes we get really busy with these things that we don't prioritize our time with God or being in community with others. So those are some messages that I feel at times I'm told to bow to. So once we've sort of put ourselves in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's shoes, continuing in verse 15, Nebuchadnezzar, you know, responding to their lack of obedience, says, if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into the blazing furnace. And then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? So in verse 16, they reply, King Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we're thrown into the furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. So we face physical persecution, but if we live in obedience, we don't face physical persecution, but the men and the women who are doing the ministry on the ground in India, they do at times face physical persecution among spiritual persecution as well. They are likely to be the victims of verbal abuse, intimidation, beatings, and maybe worse. And so as Nebuchadnezzar says to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, many of them receive that same message, right? You need to bow, you need to fit in, or else there will be consequences. And this has really grown in the past couple of years in India. There's sort of a cultural movement. There was recent elections, and this party, the BJP party, is sort of a right-wing Hindu nationalist party. And it's not their message openly to the world, but you get the sense there that in order to sort of stir up their electorate, there's this idea of if we are elected in a province, in a region, then that is a mandate that, you know, we are claiming this as Hindu land, and so no other religions should be practicing in that place. And so they did. They won majority in many places, and so many of the pastors are experiencing the backlash of that, where they're experiencing intimidation. People are told they need to leave and stop their work. And one of the regions where this is particularly hard is in Nizamabad, and these are some of the pastors from that specific region. It's very remote, and so when the population is less educated, more superstitious, they're more readily able to be manipulated by this sort of fear messaging and this desire of the majority voice. And without a steady presence of law enforcement, it can be pretty dangerous for folks who are going against the grain. And so these pastors and their wives and their congregations are risking a lot to do this work. They face idols and pressure, both spiritual and physical. Now, the second famous story, which I'm just going to reference, is that Daniel in the lion's den. And so the similar command in that story, right? There's a new king, King Darius of Persia, but just the same way, you cannot pray to any god, you can't worship anyone except for the king. And if you break this, you'll be thrown to the lion's den. So while they're living out their call to bless the nations, they're facing this pressure and this persecution to bow down, to lose their identity. And so how do they respond? What's the result? So this is in the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Many of you know, they don't die in the furnace, even though it was so hot that the men who threw them in died. They didn't smell of flame. They had no singed clothes, right? They walk out, and so the king of Babylon is astonished. How is this possible, right? And he praises them. He says, your God has rescued you. He sent his angels to rescue his servants. They trusted in him, defied the king's command, were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except for their own. And so this is the key part here. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego will be cut into pieces, for no other god can save in this way. Now, of course, he takes it a little far. He's a fallen ruler, so the whole cutting to pieces is probably not, ideal for God's mission. But this idea that this king of this foreign empire recognized the goodness and the character of these men and their God, that's really something to take note of. Now, in the other story, right, Daniel also obviously should have died in the lion's den. It says that they were so hungry that when the next people are thrown in, before their bodies hit the floor, they're ripped apart. So the lions are very hungry, and yet Daniel is not touched. He comes out unscathed, and of course, King Darius says, wow, how is this possible? And so the same thing, right? I make a decree in every part of my kingdom that people should tremble in fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, enduring forever. Now, for a king who says he's a god, that's a pretty big deal to say about someone else's god, and that he is the living God, enduring forever. This is high praise. And so I want us to take note of this, and this map is going to, in the quickest way, show what I'm talking about. So this is a map of the Persian Empire, the empire that Darius would have ruled over. And that blue circle there is the territory of Israel at its height in the Old Testament. So even at the moment, you know, under David and Solomon, their reach is pretty limited compared to that of these empires that they're living under at the end of the Old Testament. And as we said, while they were living in that land, while they had a king, while they had their temple, their ability to bless the nations was limited. They were constantly at war. They weren't following God's law. And so while they were blessed, while they had this high status, while they were in their land, they were not able to live out God's call to bless the nations in the way that they could when they were obedient under foreign rule and were willing to sort of sacrifice and give up of themselves. So I calculated, I just tried to use my thumb, that I think that circle would probably fit into the overall empire about 50 times, right? So this is a big moment. This is the moment in the Old Testament where God's glory is shown the most broadly. Now, of course, in the New Testament, this calling to self-sacrificial love was fulfilled by Jesus. And as we heard read, right, Jesus, in human form, gives himself up to die out of obedience and out of love for us. And through that sacrifice, right, he is exalted. And this is all to the glory of God. So it was through his sacrifice that God's love was displayed most powerfully. That's why we're here, right? Because Jesus did this for us. And by humbling himself to serve, he was exalted to the glory of God. And so now we, as followers of Christ, right, he calls us to that same path of service and sacrificial love. Take up your cross and follow me. And so this is the point where it clearly reflects what I saw and experienced in India among the pastors and their wives and the way that they serve. The highlight was this year that I got to hear individually from each of the pastors share about their experience from the past year. And so sort of to close here, I'm just going to highlight three of these pastors. The first one is Paul, and then Pastor Devasahayam and his wife, and then Abraham, right, living out the call to bless the nations. And they discussed it really stuck in my heart and my mind, where they were discussing their experience with intimidation. People came into their churches and threatened them. Some of them received some blows from these people, and they were telling them to stop gathering in their churches, and if they didn't, they would kill them. And so they were sharing about how others around them had closed their churches. They were not able to withstand the persecution. But these men and the other pastors, they did not feel like God was leading them to stop. They didn't bow to the pressure. And so they were called to pray for those who threatened them and continued to serve the community. I remember Paul, the first man on the left there, just saying, you know, we're here praying for these people who are threatening to beat us. And it was just with such humility and such conviction. And so over time, God has worked through their sacrificial love. They're praying for their enemies. And last year we heard how Devasahayam, at his church, which is located right next to a temple, right, they were experiencing these threats as well. And so this eye clinic became a wonderful way, practical way of showing the love of Jesus to these neighbors. And so this eye clinic became a way of, as Roman says, heaping coals on their heads, right? They realized these people are not to be feared. They're not to be attacked. They want what's best for us. They're sharing the love of Jesus with us. And so these actions soften the hearts of their Hindu neighbors, and now there are times where these Hindu neighbors will actually stand up for the Christians in their community and say, you know, leave them alone, they're fine, they want what's best for us. And so after months of praying, tensions are beginning to settle, and many others are reporting how many of these Hindu neighbors are actually coming to their churches and coming to believe in Christ after seeing this love on display. So this is the power of God's love in full display, right? Through their dedicated faith and service, these women and pastors are breaking down the lies. They're exposing corruption and showing the joy that can be found in Christ. They're taking part in God's ministry of reconciliation and living out their call to bless the nations. Thank you.
My experience was with the women, which is always very interesting. In the last few years, I've noticed some differences. Women are becoming more relaxed, are feeling more permission to speak. They did not want to speak at first, but now they will. They will respond to questions. The picture of the three pastors he just had up on here, that pastor's wife, I think it took her 3 years to smile with her mouth open like that without covering it. So it's wonderful she feels empowered that way. There's so many challenges. We had one that recently had a thyroid problem and a skin problem that Samantha was on the phone trying to find her doctors to figure out what was the problem and to address it because her quality of life was just deteriorating. Another had to deal with her sister's suicide, and the cultural demand to bury her quickly did not allow for grieving, and this is very difficult. And otherwise, just loneliness, not having anyone to talk to, being isolated in their villages. There were, this year, a number of young pastors who have joined, which was fascinating to see and very encouraging. Now it has made the group a much wider mix. Before, we had people maybe in their 30s, 40s, or 50s, maybe half of whom could not read or write, or maybe just write their name. Now, some of these young women that are there have some college education even. So you have the women who just sat there and listened, and then you had ones that were diligently taking notes because they understood this practice. And there you could just see how they want to enter into this learning process, which then brings a challenge to me, at least, and I think to others, as going in as Westerners, that we don't go and impose our Western ideals. For myself, colonialism needs to die. So I have been doing teachings on some of Paul's writings in the last few years. Jesus' teaching through Paul, let's put it that way. And which he talks a lot about ending divisions. And as Paulus was explaining the caste system, the caste system, plus we are these Americans whom they all revere, seemingly, so it makes a challenge then to get them to break through their barriers to see that we are actually one on the same level. So that is my challenge when I go, and I would ask that if I go or anyone else to pray for that we don't go imposing our Western ways of dealing with cultural structures and hierarchy, but that the Spirit's power will work with them in helping them to dismantle their own levels of separation, their own walls, that Jesus' love may be shared.
Good old time management. I encourage you not to look at your phones for the next few minutes, and I'll keep this rather short. So it's fascinating how we were all bound by that, right? So just relax. The opportunity to go to India is real. It is mostly with joy. It is the hours in the plane seat, which ones can really force you to question your decision to go in the first place. The practices that you see either from the farming, the trucking, the agriculture, the business, the lack of trust, the bartering can be overwhelming. Fascinating, like Caleb said, to get to know these pastors a bit better, one-on-one. The ability to sit with Paulus as we interview them and learn their strengths, weaknesses, what their concerns are, is just truly amazing. We were interviewing one couple about the same age, Kendra and I, and they had asked us some similar questions, and Kendra and I gave more or less try to be humorous responses. And the response from the Indian couple was, well, their marriage, they learned to be able to relax once they realized their finances where they could get to one meal a day. Well, that's soon set a reflection on me. Primarily, my message this morning to you at Plains Mennonite Church is thank you for support for Paulus and Sumata and PPMI. You have something very unique here, and that a lot of our churches and our conferences have folks who have stepped out into mission fields and have done quite well with that. But you folks at Plains have birthed this gift, sometimes understanding, sometimes not understanding, sometimes being perhaps too hard on the Thalathotes, other times perhaps not asking enough difficult questions. But I really want to affirm you as a congregation and as individuals for accepting them, for accepting this ministry. Most of us, tomorrow, throughout our working careers, we understand the word leverage. Now, I didn't think about it too much before I saw these pastors and this team that Paulus and Sumata pulled together. They understand the word leverage. I have never heard Paulus tell me that word, but he understands it rather well. So we have, Jesus had called his disciples, and few of us have the nerve to let go of our boats and our fishing nets. And Paulus and Sumata have done that. I don't know that I'm brave enough to do that. So I think about this sometimes. Paulus and Sumata have left their boat and their fishing nets and have listened to that call, said, come to follow. And so someday I would hope that Jim, regardless of, I had enough hard time growing up, regardless of the caste system. I can only imagine that difficulty yet upon us as well. But to be able to follow God's call, and then to be able to get a group of people together and use that leverage like ripples in a pond when you're skipping stones to make an impact for Jesus, that's dramatic. And you, as Plains congregation, have allowed that to happen here, have encouraged that to happen. I would encourage and suggest that you continue to nurture this gift, this plant that God has planted here. Yeah, I was impressed with the commissioning service earlier. And I know from reading Richard Lichty's book here on the history of the church at the Plains that you have many others who have gone before you. But today, we are called to embrace each other. And thank you for you embracing Paulus and Sumata, PPMI, allowing them to use that leverage of reaching others in ways that us as individuals could not.
So this year for the Women's Conference, I focused talking on showing love to people in like different settings. So the first person I talked about was Mary, and she's the one who like wept at Jesus' feet and wiped it up with her hair. And that was showing love to strangers and outcasts. And then the second one was Ruth and Naomi, which was showing love to your family. And then the parable of the lost son, which was about showing love unconditionally. The ladies really seemed to connect with it because